Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, thanks so much for your company again. Today we'll be learning a great deal about improving vagal tone from Emrys Goldsworthy, who's an expert on this, and I've podcasted with him a number of times prior. Each time he blows my mind. Welcome to Natural Medicine Podcast, Emrys. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
So we're sort of like going back to the future again, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your history as a practitioner and how you first became interested in treating or managing the vagus nerve.
Well, one of the key areas I've always worked on is the nervous system. My first area of training was in the musculoskeletal system, treating chronic pain, acute problems. And often we would be treating nerves as part of that, whether it be neuromodulation techniques, manipulation of the nerves themselves. And that grew further and further into that area as I've noticed it was the most successful way of treating patients. And as part of that, you start to investigate other nerves, not just peripheral nerves in the legs and the arms and the neck and so on. You look at the cranial nerves, which is where I started to look at the vagus nerve. And as part of that, started to understand how it was involved in the gut, in the heart, the lungs, even extending into the brain and affecting the brain's function and mood and so on. And working with a lot of other clinicians who were dealing with, you know, other nutrition, naturopaths, things like that, they were dealing with gut problems and we just started having conversations about it. It's where I started to go into it more with some of their own patients and started to look at what options I had and apply the same principles. So electrically stimulating the nerve, using light or other kinds of energy sources to stimulate the nerve. There's also manipulation of the nerve, which is kind of a massage manual therapy technique. And then it just got more and more into understanding why it becomes a dysfunctional nerve. And because it does so many things, when it is dysfunctional, it's very, very noticeable. Whereas with other nerves, you could go on for months or years and put up with it, you know, like just a bit of ache, a bit of pain, a bit of stiffness here and there, but weakness maybe. But this nerve is very different, okay? Because of its function in the viscera and the brain and many other things which we can go into, it gets a bit complicated.
Yeah.
And patients present with complex conditions.
Was there any light bulb moment for you though, or was it just this gradual interest that sort of steamrolled?
So initially, all the research pointed towards electrical stimulation. That was the main thing. There was also a bit of a note about certain conditions that seemed to go hand in hand with it. Things like hypermobility syndromes, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, mast cell activation syndrome, another one called POTS or postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Mm-hmm. And these are all kind of commonly with it. Okay. And these patients, these conditions, we see when you look at them together, you actually see they're pretty similar conditions. They just don't present identically. Just like, you know, many, you know, one cause can cause many different symptoms. It's possible that they're all caused by vagus nerve dysfunction, at least in part.
Right.
And so that's one big light bulb. But of late has been the overwhelming importance of the compression of the nerve and how much that impacts the treatment. And I've really changed how I approach vagus nerve dysfunction now with new subtypes, excessive vagal activity, low vagal activity, and how each of those can be caused by different things. And there are lots of areas where the vagus nerve can be compressed, some of which will need scans to know for sure, but by and large, you know by symptoms. So that's a big one. that actually knowing that you can treat it without using direct electrical stimulation, actually manually working the nerve by itself. And that can be enough, plus a few other things that a lot of people out there in the industry aren't even aware of. And they think that electrical stimulation is the way to go and often doesn't work. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. And of late, I've understood why.
Right. This is very interesting when you're talking about EDS. I'll separate that one, but, you know, certainly POTS and MCAS.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I hear this sort of new flavor of the month coming in
mm-hmm.
with diagnosis, I sort of have a shackle or a hackle raising about how much are we seeing what we want to see? And I see that, you know, how often have we seen these common things? It was chronic fatigue. It was multiple chemical sensitivity. There was vitamin D was the answer for everything. Cortisol's been the answer for everything. La, mm-hmm. la, 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 la. And I really do wonder if this autonomic sympathetic dysregulation can be a major part, so maybe not the cause, but a major part of what's happening in so many conditions.
Look, Andrew, I think it could be the largest cause of most chronic diseases. What, at least why it gets so much worse than it should be. I've seen so many links that in the past I don't really see the point in you know further investigating. And you know, at the moment, from the medical perspective, vagus nerve stimulation is two types. There's stimulation via the auricular ear branch through non-invasive means, just like TENS machines and things like that. That's what you'll see often in the industry. And then there's an implanted version.
Mm.
And that one, yeah, it's in the neck. That one is slowly falling in favor because of the risks of surgery and the constant need to put a new battery in and so on. But that you don't need to do that one. You don't need to do the invasive one to get the results of the TAVNS, which is the ear stimulation. And what I found is that they focus on these conditions, and it's the word, the label, migraine, right? Depression, anxiety, IBS, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, and you know, atrial fibrillation or arrhythmias. Now, medical terms are useful, but they can also be problematic. Because it doesn't tell you necessarily why it's a problem.
Yep.
And I'm more concerned with the why. And that's why when someone comes in, they say they have a migraine. And I ask, well, what else do you have? Yeah. Have you got problems with digestion? Have you also got, because migraine in itself isn't really a vagus nerve symptom.
Mm-hmm.
Migraine is trigeminal nerve, possibly to do with blood flow, all these things, these are maybes. And why does vagus nerve stimulation help people with migraine? But then when you actually look at it more holistically, you see that they are actually either a person with excessive vagal tone or low vagal tone. And they fit into one of those two boxes, or they have this type that is like a seesawing. They go in and out. So partly they're excessive, and then for a period they're at low. And that is really interesting. And there's lots of ways of knowing that, you know, and so it leads you down a track of treating them more globally rather than just the migraine. So they might say, the migraine is kind of better, but my digestion's better. And this is better. And there's other factors that you can use to lead you down the track of, okay, we're getting somewhere. And there are measurable ways to know if vagus nerve tone is improving. And we can talk about that too.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so you mentioned quite a few conditions there, but I understand your stance has changed somewhat. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So,
yeah,
I mean, the main thing is if a patient presents with chronic disease, it could be anything. It could be, you know, sensitive to everything, you know, MCAS is a very common diagnosis now. POTS is common too. And there might be fatigue. It might be brain fog. It might be chronic pain. You know, all these different sort of conditions that are really difficult to treat. You can just put them all in one basket for a moment. Mm. Then you ask the question, what's my digestion doing? Am I constipated? Or do I get diarrhea every day? Constipation is a sign of low vagal tone. Diarrhea is a sign of excessive vagal tone, hyperactive. Now, remember, if we go and look at our autonomic nervous systems, you'll see that the activity of the intestines, if it's elevated, it means the vagus nerve is elevated in activity, and it can be excessive. There is time and a place for diarrhea for elimination purposes, right? But then what I propose is that although the body is intelligent and generally speaking, it does everything because it's trying to rectify whatever's going wrong. Mm-hmm. And environmental factors, which we can talk about, are likely the cause of most problems, particularly toxins, in my opinion, right? Still, at the basis of it, we have a vagus nerve dysfunction in a lot of cases. And sorry, it's very complicated because I actually suspect that it is the core, because the vagus nerve is nearly involved in every single part of detoxification, and it's part of detecting toxins. So a lot of people will say, well, why is the vagus nerve a problem considering most of what we're dealing with is environmental toxicity? That's kind of the big thing at the moment, right? You know, you've got plastics in the environment, you've got metals in the environment, you've got other things as well, you know, the mm-hmm. list goes on.
Yep.
And why are you becoming a reductionist and going, it's all the vagus nerve? Well, I'm not. I still believe the vagus nerve is being affected by toxins. But I think that when the vagus nerve becomes dysfunctional, you don't properly detoxify.
Right. So you've got a couple catch 22.
Yes, it's kind of you're locked in a cycle of poor detoxification. And there's two ways that this happens. It happens through a means of not sensing toxins adequately, because the vagus nerve senses toxins that are breathed in and eaten or drunk. Okay, so because the receptors in the gut lining are vagally mediated, and the lungs too. And to a certain extent, the nasopharynx region, okay? Although that's through other nerves, through the trigeminal nerves. Now, if it doesn't sense properly, it means things get in and we don't have an adequate response. And then if it can't properly detoxify because it has low function, we have circulation. And to make matters worse, the vagus nerve has a huge role to play in maintaining the blood-brain barrier, because it modulates our astrocytes. And when it doesn't maintain the blood-brain barrier, toxins get in the brain. But the lymphatic system of the brain is controlled primarily by the vagus nerve.
Right.
And another really interesting thing, sorry to throw all these things out, but we're on a track, we may as well go there. It turns out, based on a paper I read recently as part of writing my book, lymphatic system has little actin, it's a muscle type cell that allows it to move fluid. We thought it was passive system and based on muscle contraction and backflow and things like that, but it turns out it does have this ability to move fluid. And in this paper, they found that the vagus nerve innervated this.
Wow.
Now,
again,
we need further research into it, but as far as I'm concerned, that makes a lot of sense. Why do people develop this systemic level of lymphatic congestion when they have excessive inflammation? Well, we know that when the vagus nerve is not working properly, inflammation skyrockets.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go down that track. That's a whole other thing, right? And then the lymph doesn't move. Well, this is probably the same cause, isn't it? So the brain, everyone goes on about the brain and how, you know, we've got to detoxify the brain for kids and adults that have brain-based conditions. You know, you might say dementia is an example. As an example, there might also be mood disorders, possibly, definitely brain fog. If the vagus nerve is involved in nearly every point of concern when it comes to detoxification of the brain, and I've only mentioned a very small proportion of it, then and the body, not just mention the brain. And the lymphatic system is our sewage for toxins. What's going to happen? It's basically just going to linger in the body, circulate. And one of the really interesting things about when you get to down to the causes, you know, there's a lot of patients that will come in and they'll say, I got sick, virus, flu, whatever, sick, okay? Mm. And then they got vagus nerve problems. Now, I don't think it's anything to do with some pathogen. I don't think it's anything to do with that. That's my belief. And I truly don't believe it has any relationship to it. But what I do think is that they weren't really sick from a virus. Oh. You look at many different things out there that cause people to be sick, and one of them is toxins. And even low-grade exposure to metals causes cold-like symptoms. Even low-grade exposure to any of these toxins. We can't get away from them. They're everywhere. Plastics are one of the worst, like I've mentioned, and we all try our best to limit our exposure. But half the toxins we don't even know are there. They're just circulating.
Yeah.
If our if our body's unable to handle it, you know, what is the domino effect of that?
Yeah. Every single time I speak with you, you blow my mind. Muscle type cells in the lymphatic system. Yeah. Like what?
I know. I was shocked. To be honest, I was shocked. That was an old paper, but you know, in my area, there's a big movement towards lymphatics, right? Improving lymphatics.
Hmm.
But if lymphatics are controlled by a system that is basically the nervous system, not just this like flaccid system of tunnels, then we have a whole other thing going on here.
Yeah.
We have a system that is, I mean, I've always believed the nervous system is king of the body. The brain and the nervous system controls everything. Don't think otherwise. We know that it affects glands. We know that it affects the endocrine system. We know that it affects the immune system. Well, the vagus nerve certainly does.
Mm.
And, you know, we go down this track. Where does it lead us? So coming back to the fact that the vagus nerve is impaired by possible toxin exposure, but also it being impaired causes further exposure, okay? What are other things? You know, I mentioned the idea that someone can get sick and then get a problem. I don't believe that that's the end of the story. I believe that there is another part of the story. There is the foundation of vagus nerve dysfunction already present. And I believe, by and large, there are particular cases where the vagus nerve is being compressed by masses like tumors, even certain types of aneurysms in the viscera around, you know, aortic arch, things like that, can actually push on different parts of the vagus nerve. But leaving all of these other tumor-based ones aside, everything basically below the neck, the vagus nerve generally gets compressed in the neck as it leaves the cranium through the jugular foramen up here. And as it descends down a thing called the carotid sheath, this shares the space with the carotid artery. And in this space, we get our problems. Generally, if I was to bet money, person comes in, that's where it's going to be. And when it isn't, that's where you go and look at other tests. But generally speaking, for these people, you need that kind of compression to get systemic problems.
Right.
When you get compression of the nerve further away from its source, you get local problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just a vocal change. Just my voice went and nothing else is a problem. Okay.
You also said something about the low-level metal exposure with cold-like symptoms. I've never heard this before.
Oh, yeah.
What sort of metals? What are we talking about?
Mercury, cadmium, lead, aluminium, just what you mainly see. There's a lot of aluminium in the air.
Yeah.
You know, you might have heard about how cold environments are much more exposed to organophosphates, because organophosphates rise up to the atmosphere and drop in a colder area. It's something to do with them saying in a gas form versus a fluid form, liquid form.
Yeah.
And they found that people who were in, you know, more northern latitudes or southern latitudes, colder climates, had much more organophosphates, this women, in their breast milk. They measured breast milk versus ones that were closer to the equator.
Wow.
And when do we notice colds more?
The colder climates. Yeah.
And where do, I mean, there are things that happen during summer. I'm not saying it's all one thing.
Mm.
But this is a big thing. And it's easy to blame a virus. It's easy to blame it on something that many people don't even test for. You can do a test on anything and on a healthy person, come up with something positive. It doesn't mean it causes their symptoms. Now, I'm not saying everyone is like this, but I'm just saying we need more investigation with every patient that walks through the door. And metals are a big one. Organophosphates are another.
But it's very interesting what you're saying about cold. You know, there's been that old research now about people being sneezed upon to give them a cold and they failed. And it's more the fomites. It's more the fomites. It's more touching handles and things like that. And then for some reason, why, I don't know, but for some reason, that action.
Have a think about
touching the face.
If you do a PubMed search on a thing called street dust or road dust. And in different cities, there's different amounts. But generally speaking, there's heavy metals in that road dust.
Right.
And how much of that, you know, toxic, you know, and a lot of it comes from brakes. I don't know if you know that, but
yes,
a lot of metal, asbestos as well.
Car brakes, like that.
We touch this stuff. And then it kind of makes sense that if you touch it and put it to your face, it's going to cause a problem.
Mm.
Because you're breathing in inadvertently things that are toxic, and you're in a toxic environment. And even if you go to the country, you're still going to get exposed to organophosphates and other things as well. It's not like you miss out on things. And that's why it affects everyone everywhere. Mm. And I don't think we can really get away from it. But this is why it comes back to the vagus nerve, because if we have a dysfunctional vagus nerve, we have a dysfunctional system already in place. We can't defend ourselves adequately.
Yeah.
We can clean our water. I have distilled water every day. I do 100% clean water. I can filter my air as much as I can. I can eat organic food every day, and I can eat organic meat. I can have the best diet.
Then
you've got to
go out.
And I'm still sick.
Yeah.
Not fixing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So then this then begs the question, you've done everything right. Now let's look at your nervous system. Is it doing what it's meant to do internally? And everyone wants to do things like take herbs, which is not bad, not disregarding it, or take supplements, more vitamin C, more vitamin D. And I mean, that can definitely play a huge role. But I want to add something else to the
whole thing.
And that is that the vagus nerve must be functional 100% in order to prevent further excessive illness. And it might be a really important part in the future. It certainly is for me in my clinic, but I want everyone else to be aware that they need to consider it. And unfortunately, doing simple vagal resets is not sufficient by and large. This is why we need to talk about the true underlying cause of a lot of it. Now, I'll lead you into that now. The vagus nerve by and large is caused by dysfunction, is caused by compression, not by stress, not by these things that I might have mentioned in the past. I've disregarded that because I just don't believe it anymore. I think those are exacerbators. It is caused by pure nerve compression. And there are two types. There are constant nerve compression. It's generally something quite large, a bony eminence. So bony irregularities in your neck or some kind of swelling. So it could actually be lymph node swelling or a tumor. You need these things examined. And I palpate patients. I can find what's really going on.
Yeah.
Or it's what's called transient compression, which is the more common. And what transient compression is where the nerve gets tightened, strangulated by a few abnormalities in the neck on and off. And it can lead to two states, hyperactivity, which is called excessive vagal tone, and low activity, which is called low vagal tone. And we should talk about the different types so that people can recognize them.
Mm, please.
This thing about the neck, people have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, nearly always have vagus nerve problems, and they're hypermobile. And the one region in the body that is very hypermobile with people is the neck. It's already hypermobile and unstable in it as it is. It's further unstable.
Yeah.
And we know that these people, as they strengthen their necks, as part of my protocol, as you get stronger necks through rehabilitation exercises, very simple, their vagus nerve symptoms start to dissipate. Before we've even administered any electrical stimulation, before we've administered any nerve manipulation, strengthening the cervical spine musculature improves symptoms more readily than any other maneuver or any other technique. And it's just the low-hanging fruit that people don't understand because it doesn't make sense. How could neck strengthening help my disease? It makes sense to me because it's the area I've particularly focused on in the last couple of years, particularly as we've come to a better understanding of why these conditions come up with the vagus nerve.
It actually does make sense to me. It's one of the issues I've had with constant chiropractic manipulation or the need for
that's
constant.
A problem. Yes.
You know,
yes.
Without looking at the reasons why somebody needs the constant manipulation.
I agree. I totally agree.
Without looking at the musculature, without looking at strength or relaxation or muscle tension and, you know, emotional issues that impact that tension, like stressors, whether they be emotional or toxic or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
You're not going to get to the real answer.
So the neck muscles, right? This works for everywhere else in the body. When you have a joint that is unstable, meaning it shifts and slides a little bit, and you don't feel that, right? But it shifts and slides when you load it, right? So it could be through movement, could be through using your arms, could be through any kind of, you know, mechanical motion. The muscles will get tight, and it's a normal reflex when you have weakness. Muscles go really tight because they become more efficient at contracting when they're tight. They don't stay in a normal tone. So you're going to see this pathway where the vagus nerve runs in a little sheath, little surrounding connective tissue cylinder. And those muscles there go, "Arr!" What's going to happen? You're going to get compression.
Yeah.
And if you have other structural abnormalities there, you might have bony spurs. You might have even just movement of the vertebra themselves. You know, all of these things can impact and cause nerve compression. And by and large, that's where the treatment ends up going. And that's why a lot of people don't get anywhere. That's what I'm saying. And so it can lead to excessive or low vagal tone. And we still do electrical stimulation because what happens is over time, that nerve declines. Part of the reason that it's a problem is because the blood flow is also diminished to the nerve because the blood vessels wrapping around the nerve have been constricted as well, low oxygen environments.
Yep.
And that's problematic as well. So it can decline and damage long term if it's been there for a long time. That's why you do electrical stimulation, improve the system's ability to function. But doing electrical stimulation first is not adequate anymore.
Got it. Yeah, got it. Can I ask though, and I normally cover this sort of thing later on, but I think we need to cover this now, and that is the temptation to massage the area where the carotid artery and the baroreceptors are fraught with issues.
Yeah,
how do we address that in a safe way? Yeah,
yeah. So that's why you need a trained clinician. You need someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
I've spent my entire career palpating nerves, and you know the carotid artery is right there. You know, by and large, people, it's pretty safe to massage through there, but there are definitely people that you just don't do that, right?
Yeah.
You know, not to mention the fact that we don't know what the side effects of that could be with that person. They might have turbulent blood flow through there for any number of atherosclerotic reasons. There might be that. We're not unaware of really the potential of it. So first, do no harm principles. And for me, there's lots of methods that I do to improve that neuromobility, that nerve mobility through there that don't necessarily require direct manually moving it. Okay. You can do it through indirect means.
Yeah, gotcha.
People should be very careful what self-treating. I mean, I see it all the time. People self-treat and they just don't realize that they may not be doing the right thing. They may be doing it in the wrong manner. They may actually make it worse. I'm sure there is a bunch of people out there that have low vagal tone. They do carotid massage and these things they've read online and they improve, but that's not the majority.
Right.
You see a lot of disappointed people in the vagus nerve groups that I see online. Yeah.
So with regards to treatment, has your treatment, your approach to treatment changed like 180 degrees since
100%.
You and I passed 100%. Podcast?
Yes, exactly. And one of the main things that's changed is really just trying to figure out where it's compressed.
Right.
That's the main thing for me. And then getting strength back in the neck. And there are small, there's not just two nerves of the vagus nerve. There's the carotid branch, the cardiac branch,
yeah,
the recurrent laryngeal, the pharyngeal branch. There's a bunch of different ones. And they are different techniques for different nerves of the actual vagus nerve group, complex, you might say. And I do a lot of different techniques. I have a lot of different therapies. I'm lucky in that regard. I have shockwave therapy, laser therapy. I do a type of needling where we use the needle near a nerve and around it to reduce the connective tissue adhesions. There's lots of different things that can be done beyond just simply manipulating the nerve. And I'm lucky as I have those options. But there are things people can do from home, particularly if their condition is not excessive and it's not severe, right? It's very hard to self-treat severe conditions, you know, but we can talk about that. But I think it's important that people need to know that low vagal tone isn't the only vagal problem.
Right.
You know, excessive vagal tone is too. And so low vagal tone is the kind of picture there is difficulty swallowing. You don't have to have all of these. These are just examples. Difficulty swallowing. Reflux because the lower esophageal sphincter is not closing properly because it's innervated by the vagus nerve. Then you have poor digestion due to poor secretion of enzymes and stomach acid and so on. That's low vagal tone. Then you can have things like we've categorized as SIBO, right? So that'll be low vagal tone. Constipation, low vagal tone. There's a bit of disparity whether anxiety and depression, one is one or one is the other. Either way, it's vagal dysfunction. Not always. Your mother just died. Your wife just, you know, that's normal depression, anxiety. I'm just referring to abnormal, particularly when it is concurrent with a vocal change or a constipation problem or, you know, someone heart problem. Tachycardia is low vagal tone. If it's vagal, it'll be low vagal. Okay. There are other versions. Arrhythmias can be low vagal tone, like atrial fibrillation. Sleep abnormalities can be low vagal tone too. One of the weird ones is breathing. So low vagal tone increases generally your breath rate, but excessive slows it down and it can make you feel like you have a tight chest, like an asthma symptom.
Right.
Another weird symptom that I often see is a symptom of not feeling the urgency to breathe. So that could be the sense that the CO2 levels, when they rise, our chemoreceptors.
Oh, yeah, in the brain.
And that they're not sensing the CO2 rise. So you don't feel the urgency to breathe. They're innervated by the vagus nerve, partly.
Mm.
And so that could be low vagal tone as an example. That's not a common symptom, but that's an example. And then you go to something like high vagal tone or excessive. And so that would be low heart rate, relatively low heart rate, bradycardic, possibly low blood tone, blood pressure, possibly, although that's a difficult one because there's a lot of factors. A lot of them have this vasovagal syncope. Then you have possible this sort of overwhelming need to sort of be you can't mount a stress response. You're down, you're low, not necessarily depressed, but
exhausted sort of thing.
It can be what is actually chronic fatigue. And it's this excessive vagal tone where it's due to vagus nerve dysfunction, same causes, but you basically just can't mount a response. So you have poor sympathetic tone and really, really high vagal tone. And that's why often, you know, those people, you need to get their sympathetic nervous system elevated and you've got to normalize the vagus nerve function. So a bit of both. It's always a seesaw. You know, as vagus nerve goes up, sympathetic goes down and vice versa. And often everyone attacks the sympathetic nervous system and they want low sympathetic tone. That's not good. That means you can't exercise. That means you can't mount response when needed. It means you go limp when you have a stress response. And I'm all for things like the Wim Hof breathing in certain contexts, elevate sympathetic tone, or exercise when it's appropriate. And there's other means that I do as well that are more clinical. But people do get stuck in the mindset. They do.
Are there any instances where these symptoms that you've spoken about, particularly sympathetic innervation, is not governed by vagal de-innervation?
Do you mean like a hyperactive sympathetic nervous system is not related to the vagus nerve?
Yeah.
I think the problem is they're not separate systems. You know, so for example, during the fight or flight response, the vagus nerve is actually activated.
Yeah.
So it's not a dichotomy. It's not black and white. So in order to vomit, in order to have a nauseous, if you, let's just say this, you consume a toxin and then you get nauseous and you want to vomit, your heart rate goes up and you've got a sympathetic response and you're sweating.
Mm.
You've got a fever, but then you vomit.
Mm.
The vagus nerve is activated and the sympathetic nervous system is activated at the same time. They are not necessarily not working together. No. They do different things.
Yeah, right.
And this is why it's complicated, because they're an alliance to protect the organism, us, from the environment, from things that might kill us and hurt us. You know, we need the sympathetic nervous system to stay alert, to maintain normal function of our brain as well. Mm. You know, we need cortisol to be properly binding to its receptors in order to get the positive effects of it. We don't want, you know, we can go down cortisol discussion because that's a big part of it.
No.
That's another thing. Huge. Another day. But these are all big things and we need to not talk about it in black and white.
Right.
Sympathetic nervous system is not bad. Cortisol is not bad. It's when it becomes dysfunctional and that's not necessarily elevated excessively. And we need to consider that the autonomic nervous system is one thing and the function of it requires everything to be healthy and functional. Their pathways need to be clear. The vagus nerve is vulnerable. It is in a vulnerable position in the neck. And that's the unfortunate thing.
Is there any safe interventions? You mentioned neck exercises, but are there any other safe interventions that patients can do at home? Like, for instance, that periauricular stimulation.
Yep.
Is this advocated still, or do you really need to figure out if there's compression and therefore
you do.
The vagal nerve stimulation won't really help you?
Yeah. Truthfully, you do. You do. You do need to know that. You know, like you see the 100 ways to stimulate your vagus nerve. This is not about stimulating the vagus nerve. This is about returning the function of the vagus nerve because it's impaired. Like someone stood on a hose, you don't just keep stimulating, you don't just keep turning the tap on and expect, you know,
yeah.
It can work. But I will say it's important to maintain a healthy vagus nerve. And that is where exercises do come in. For example, the classic one is diaphragmatic breathing. Diaphragmatic breathing basically means that your hands are placed around your lower rib cage and your abdomen, and you breathe into your hands and you do it slowly. You can control your vagus nerve by slowing down your breath. You'll lower your heart rate. All of these things can impact. That is a form of vagal resetting because it's utilizing what you can change. You can change your breath, right? You can slow it down. There are other ways. One of the key ones is utilizing the larynx. So vocal things are very, very effective. In fact, it's one of the most effective. So singing, most people don't sing. But if you go and learn singing, you actually, let's say you're sick and you want to help yourself and you can't get to someone who can help you, pick up singing, learn how to sing and do difficult songs. I know probably most people aren't going to be very good at it. It's not about that. It's about learning to sing. It's like when you want to challenge your brain, you learn a language as an example.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're going to be good at it. Doesn't mean you shouldn't try. In this case, we need to do that for our vagus nerve. We need to challenge parts of it in order to stimulate it. Okay. Now, a lot of people improve by doing that, by joining a singing group, learning how to sing. They do. That's not going to be sufficient for many people.
Right.
Additionally, we always used to talk about gargling. Now, gargling is still utilized because gargling will activate the muscles in the back of the throat. You can also stimulate your gag reflex, which I don't necessarily use a lot, but gargling is sufficient. Okay.
What if you've got compression though, and you don't know it because you haven't had it assessed? Are there any things? Are there any particular ways that would be good or bad? And how can one tell if compression is the issue?
I do some tests where I palpate the nerve and see if it moves and things like that. So it takes a lot of training to do that. But many people will, not everyone will have this because it requires further analysis, but they will be tender between their trachea and their SCM muscle. In this space, they will be tender through there. And it might be more tender on one side. They might be tender up in that sort of jugular area.
Yeah, yeah.
And they
just palpating the sternocleidomastoid, just that area.
Exactly. Just inside of it. That tells you. Yeah. And that's not the confirming test.
No, no.
Right. But that can, if you are really tender there, it probably means there's something going wrong. If it was a peripheral nerve, that's partly how I would find out if there was a problem in that nerve, right? So nerves shouldn't be tender. They shouldn't be. They're sensitized to pressure in that case. Mm. That means there is something impairing the blood flow to the nerve or compressing it. That's how it works with peripheral nerves. That's how it works with the vagus nerve, because in the case of the neck, it is a peripheral nerve. So then beyond that, often people will say they have a weak neck or a stiff neck. That might be a factor as well. That might indicate some weakness, which is what we need to address nearly always, right? They might also say that if you're lying down and you go to lift your head up to look at your toes, just your head, if you find that difficult, well, you shouldn't find that difficult, but a lot of people do. And that's another indication that you have at least a lack of stability in the neck. It doesn't necessarily mean you have compression, but that could be a good informative piece, that information that you could lead you to say, I need to get this rectified.
Yeah.
Some people who have hypermobility syndromes know their neck is unstable, right? And they know one of the ways you know is you get your neck adjusted or treated and it gets worse, or it feels better and then it gets worse or comes back again within days. Those are great indicators that your neck is unstable, and positionally it just keeps moving. And it needs not massage, not releasing, but it needs strengthening. And you might know someone, you might know a trainer or someone who knows how to do neck strengthening. And by and large, it's not unsafe if you're under guidance. I do my best to not lead people down a track where they can hurt themselves, but also help themselves.
Yeah.
And it's a fine line sometimes, but most neck exercises that are, you know, not too invasive, not too intense for the neck are safe.
Yeah. And can I ask Emrys about, are there any classic factors? You mentioned a few, I think, like one was asthma, but do you find that there might be like a triad, let's say, of symptoms where somebody's got an issue with vagal tone?
Yeah. So the classic thing is they have digestive problems, right? They normally have some kind of brain-based problem, whether it's anxiety, depression, or brain fog. But we could even go down the path of things like ADHD and things like that, possibly. I'm not saying it's caused by vagus nerve, but it can be exacerbated by it. And then they have a heart problem. Now, the heart problem is normally tachycardia or bradycardia or arrhythmia. Okay. And people often use the measurement of heart rate variability. It's something that you can often use with your Apple Watch or another, chest strap, things like that. that can measure your vagal tone and see whether you're really, really high. And they look for that. They're like, oh, it's great. You've got high vagal tone. And, but they've still got the, they've got the symptoms of excessive vagal tone. And the only way I use those is I use them on patients and I ask them to buy the equipment to do it consistently so that we see a measure over a week rather than a session, which can be very erroneous. But what I'm saying is though, that can give you a good indication. But staying with the kind of triad, you might say, it's heart, gut, brain. Heart, gut, brain. And there could be a lung.
Right.
And there could be other things, right? That's not to say that they aren't those. Kidney, certainly kidney problems, genitourinary, detoxification. I mean, it all could come down to that, you know. And the other one, other areas like vocal and swallowing, reflux, but they're kind of gut.
Yeah.
Vocalism, but they're kind of gut. Yeah. So, and you, if it goes on either spectrum, it can be vagal. It can either be excessive activity in the system or low activity in the system, but both can be due to vagus nerve dysfunction.
I've got to say, Emrys, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Mostly I'll have, you know, half a page, maybe a page of notes. I've got 2.5 pages of notes with you. I'm always learning so much. But where can we find out more? You told me the other day, you texted me or something, and you've written a book now. Is that right?
Yes, The Vagus Nerve, it's called. It's just called The Vagus Nerve.
Right.
So that's on Amazon. And, yeah, I have courses in the vagus nerve for the general public, but they are quite advanced. And then they're for clinicians primarily to learn more and understand the as in-depth as we can go at the stage of our learning and our understanding in the research. But beyond that, I have a course for clinicians to learn how to utilize in their own clinic. Not every clinician has the appropriate qualifications to do it, but by and large, many people do, and we discuss what their options are. And there's not one way to treat it other than to consider all the things I've talked about. And that's why a good referral network is important. Beyond this, I also, because I do a lot of work with chronic pain, I treat peripheral nerves. So I have courses in that as well. And so that tends to be people in the realm of like physiotherapy and manual therapies and so on. But a lot of people want to learn about the vagus nerve. So I've got that course and the advanced. So the book, the courses, and my clinic, of course, which I work here in Brisbane.
And the book is for the layperson or for practitioners?
It's for both. I found that instead of like trying to do two books, I'm doing one. And yes, there'll be sections that are very difficult to understand, but they are not for necessarily everyone in each chapter. It's a go-to textbook, or not book rather, and it gives you some tools we've talked about, some more, that are safe to do it from home, and explains things like TAVNS and the implanted device. It doesn't teach you how to do those. It's not safe to do that unless you're under training, and you're being looked after by a clinician. Talks about how vagus nerve is more than likely connected to POTS, mast cell, and Ehlers-Danlos, and it goes very much as in-depth, probably more in depth than any other book that's out there on the vagus nerve.
This is so interesting, particularly with mast cell activation syndrome. I find that highly interesting.
Definitely.
Emrys, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Well, for Natural Medicine Podcast, this is the first time we've podcasted, but speaking with you again, it's always an absolute joy. And I always learn so much. Thank you so much.
It's
thank
always
you.
Great to chat.
An absolute pleasure. And everyone, thank you for joining us. We'll be putting as much information up as we can. There's only a short space that we can fit in the show notes, but I'm telling you, we'll shove it full of information for you. So thank you so much for joining us. And you can find out everything else on naturalmedicinepartners.com.au. I'm Andrew Whitfield Cook. See you next time.